when he had gathered strength, he came down from the north by sea and by land. And crossing the river Harnin, his armies utterly defeated the men of Harad, and their kings were compelled to acknowledge the overlordship of Gondor. Kiriahir then took the name of Hyamendakil, South Victor. The might of Hyamendakil no enemy dared to contest during the remainder of his long reign. He was king for 134 years, the longest reign but one of all the line of Anarion. In his day, Gondor reached the summit of its power. The realm then extended north to Celebrant and the southern eaves of Mirkwood, west to the Grey Flood, east to the inland sea of Rune, south to the river Harnan, and thence along the coast to the peninsula and haven of Umbar. The men of the Vales of Anduin acknowledged its authority, and the kings of the Harad did homage to Gondor, and their sons lived as hostages in the court of its king. Mordor was desolate, but was watched over by the great fortresses that guarded the passes. So ended the line of the ship-kings. At-Tanatar Alcarin, son of Hyamendakil, lived in great splendour, so that men said, "Precious stones are pebbles in Gondor for children to play with." But At-Tanatar loved ease, and did nothing to maintain the power that he had inherited, and his two sons were of like temper. The waning of Gondor had already begun before he died, and was doubtless observed by its enemies. The watch upon Mordor was neglected. Nonetheless, it was not until the days of Valakar that the first great evil came upon Gondor, the civil war of the kinstrife, in which great loss and ruin was caused and never fully repaired. Minalcar, son of Calmakil, was a man of great vigour, and in 1240 Narmakil, to rid himself of all cares, made him regent of the realm. From that time onwards he governed Gondor in the name of the kings until he succeeded his father. His chief concern was with the Northmen. These had increased greatly in the peace brought by the power of Gondor. The king showed them favour, since they were the nearest in kin of lesser men to the Dúnedain, being for the most part descendants of those peoples from whom the Edain of old had come. And they gave them wide lands beyond Anduin, south of Greenwood the Great, to be a defence against men of the east. In the past, the attacks of the Easterlings had come mostly over the plain between the inland sea and the Ash Mountains. In the days of Narmakil the First, their attacks began again, though at first with little force. But it was learned by the regent that the Northmen did not always remain true to Gondor, and some would join forces with the Easterlings, either out of greed for spoil, or in the furtherance of feuds among their princes. Minalcar, therefore, in 1248, led out a great force, and between Rovanion and the inland sea he defeated a large army of the Easterlings and destroyed all their camps and settlements east of the sea. He then took the name of Romendakil. On his return, Romendakil fortified the west shore of Anduin as far as the inflow of the Limlight, and forbade any stranger to pass down the river beyond the Emynweal. He it was that built the pillars of the Argonath at the entrance to Nenhithuel. But since he needed men, and desired to strengthen the bond between Gondor and the Northmen, he took many of them into his service, and gave to some high rank in his armies. Romendakil showed a special favour to Vidugavir, who had aided him in the war. He called himself King of Rovanion, and was indeed the most powerful of the northern princes, though his own realm lay between Greenwood and the river Kelduin. In 1250, Romendakil sent his son Valakar as an ambassador to dwell for a while with Vidugavir, and made himself acquainted with the language, manners, and policies of the Northmen. But Valakar far exceeded his father's designs. He grew to love the northern lands and people, and he married Vidumavi, daughter of Vidugavir. It was some years before he returned. From this marriage came later the War of the Kinstrife. for the high men of Gondor already looked askance at the Northmen among them, and it was a thing unheard of before that the heir of the crown, or any son of the king, should wed one of lesser and alien race. There was already rebellion in the southern provinces when King Valacar grew old. His queen had been a fair and noble lady, but short-lived according to the fate of lesser men, and the Dúnedain feared that her descendants would prove the same, and fall from the majesty of the kings of men. Also, they were unwilling to accept as lord her son, who, though he was now called Eldacar, had been born in an alien country, and was named in his youth Vinitharia, a name of his mother's people. Therefore, when Eldacar succeeded his father, there was war in Gondor. But Eldacar did not prove easy to thrust from his heritage. To the lineage of Gondor he added the fearless spirit of the Northmen. He was handsome and valiant, and showed no sign of aging more swiftly than his father. When the confederates, led by descendants of the king, rose against him, he opposed them to the end of his strength. At last he was besieged in Osgiliath, and held it long, until hunger and the greater forces of the rebels drove him out, leaving the city in flames. In that siege and burning, the tower of the dome of Osgiliath was destroyed, and the Palantir was lost in the waters. But Eldacar eluded his enemies, and came to the north, to his kinsfolk in Rovanion. Many gathered to him there, both of the Northmen in the service of Gondor, and of the Dúnedain of the northern parts of the realm. For many of the latter had learned to esteem him, and many more came to hate his usurper. This was Castamir, grandson of Kalimeta, younger brother of Romendakil II. He was not only one of those nearest by blood to the crown, but he had the greatest following of all the rebels, for he was the captain of ships, and was supported by the people of the coasts, and of the great havens of Pelagia and Umbar. Castamir had not long sat upon the throne before he proved himself haughty and ungenerous. He was a cruel man, as he had first shown in the taking of Osgiliath. He caused Ornendil, son of Eldacar, who was captured, to be put to death, and the slaughter and destruction done in the city at his bidding far exceeded the needs of war. This was remembered in Minas Anor and in Ithilien. And their love for Castamir was further lessened when it became seen that he cared little for the land, and thought only of the fleets, and purposed to remove the king's seat to Pelagia. Thus he had been king only 10 years, when Eldacar, seeing his time, came with a great army out of the north, and folk flocked to him from Cullenarthon and Anorion and Ithilien. There was a great battle in Lebennin at the crossings of Erwy, in which much of the best blood in Gondor was shed. Eldacar himself slew Castamir in battle, and so was avenged for Onendil, but Castamir's sons escaped, and with others of their kin, and many people of the fleets, they held out long at Pelagia. When they had gathered there all the force that they could, for Eldacar had no ships to beset them by sea, they sailed away, and established themselves at Umbar. There they made a refuge for all the enemies of the king, and a lordship independent of his crown. Umbar remained at war with Gondor for many lives of men, a threat to its coastlands and to all traffic on the sea. It was never again completely subdued until the days of Elessar, and the region of South Gondor became a debatable land between the corsairs and the kings. The loss of Umbar was grievous to Gondor, not only because the realm was diminished in the south and its hold upon the men of the Harad was loosened, but because it was there that Ar-Tharazôn the Golden, last king of Numenor, had landed and humbled the might of Sauron. Though great evil had come after, even the followers of Elendil remembered with pride the coming of the great host of Ar-Tharazôn out of the deeps of the sea, and on the highest hill of the headland above the haven they had set a great white pillar as a monument. It was crowned with a globe of crystal that took the rays of the sun and of the moon, and shone like a bright star that could be seen in clear weather, even on the coasts of Gondor, or far out upon the western sea. So it stood, Until after the second arising of Sauron, which now approached, Umbar fell under the domination of his servants, and the memorial of his humiliation was thrown down. After the return of Eldakar, the blood of the kingly house and other houses of the Dunedain became more mingled with that of lesser men, for many of the great had been slain in the kinstrife, while Eldakar showed favour to the Northmen, by whose help he had regained the crown, and the people of Gondor were replenished by great numbers that came from Rovanion. This mingling did not at first hasten the waning of the Dunedain, as had been feared, but the waning still proceeded, little by little, as it had before. For no doubt it was due, above all, to Middle-earth itself, and to the slow withdrawing of the gifts of the Numenoreans after the downfall of the Land of the Star. Eldakar lived to his 235th year, and was king for 58 years, of which 10 were spent in exile. The second and greatest evil came upon Gondor in the reign of Telemnar, the 26th king, whose father Midardil, son of Eldakar, was slain at Pelargir by the corsairs of Umbar. They were led by Angamite and Sangahayanda, the great-grandsons of Castamir. Soon after, a deadly plague came with dark winds out of the east. The king and all his children died, and great numbers of the people of Gondor, especially those that lived in Osgiliath. Then, for weariness and fewness of men, the watch on the borders of Mordor ceased, and the fortresses that guarded the passes were unmanned. Later it was noted that these things happened even as the shadow grew deep in Greenwood, and many evil things reappeared, signs of the arising of Sauron. It is true that the enemies of Gondor also suffered, or they might have overwhelmed it in its weakness. But Sauron could wait, and it may well be that the opening of Mordor was what he chiefly desired. When King Telemnar died, the white trees of Minas Anor also withered and died. But Tarondor, his nephew, who succeeded him, replanted a seedling in the citadel. He it was who removed the king's house permanently to Minas Anor, for Osgiliath was now partly deserted and began to fall into ruin. Few of those who had fled from the plague into Ithilien or to the western dales were willing to return. Tarondor, coming young to the throne, had the longest reign of all the kings of Gondor, but he could achieve little more than the reordering of his realm within and the slow nursing of his strength. But Telumetar, his son, remembering the death of Minardil, and being troubled by the insolence of the corsairs, who raided his coasts even as far as the Anfalas, gathered his forces, and 1810 took Umbar by storm. In that war the last descendants of Castamir perished, and Umbar was again held for a while by the kings. Telumatar added to his name the title Umbardakil. But in the new evils that soon befell Gondor, Umbar was again lost, and fell into the hands of the men of Harad. The third evil was the invasion of the Wainriders, which sapped the waning strength of Gondor in wars that lasted for almost 100 years. The Wainriders were a people, or a confederacy of many peoples, that came from the east. But they were stronger and better armed than any that had appeared before. They journeyed in great wains, and their chieftains fought in chariots. Stirred up, as was afterwards seen, by the emissaries of Sauron, they made a sudden assault upon Gondor, and King Narmakil II was slain in battle with them beyond Anduin in 1856. The people of eastern and southern Rovanion were enslaved, and the frontiers of Gondor were for that time withdrawn to the Anduin and the Emynweal. At this time it is thought that the Ringwraiths re-entered Mordor. Calimetar, son of Narmakil II, helped by a revolt in Rovanion avenged his father with a great victory over the Easterlings upon Dagolad in 1899, and for a while the peril was averted. It was in the reign of Arafant in the north, and Ondaher, son of Kalimeta, in the south, that the two kingdoms again took counsel together after long silence and estrangement. For at last they perceived that some single power and will was directing the assault from many quarters upon the survivors of Numenor. It was at that time that Arvedwë, heir of Arafant, wedded Firiel, daughter of Ondaher, 1940. But neither kingdom was able to send help to the other, for Angmar renewed its attack upon Arthedain at the same time as the Wainriders reappeared in great force. Many of the Wainriders now passed south of Mordor and made alliance with men of Khand and near Harad, and in this great assault from north and south Gondor came near to destruction. In 1944 King Ondaher and both his sons Artamir and Faramir fell in battle north of the Morannon, and the enemy poured into Ithilien. But Eärnil, captain of the southern army, won a great victory in South Ithilien and destroyed the army of Harad that had crossed the river Poros. Hastening north, he gathered to him all that he could of the retreating northern army, and came up against the main camp of the Wainriders while they were feasting and revelling, believing that Gondor was overthrown and that nothing remained but to take the spoil. Eärnil stormed the camp and set fire to the Wains, and drove the enemy in a great rout out of Ithilien. A great part of those who fled before him perished in the dead marshes. On the death of Ondaher and his sons, Arvedwë of the North Kingdom claimed the crown of Gondor as the direct descendant of Isildur, and as the husband of Firiel, only surviving child of Ondaher. The claim was rejected. In this, Pelennor, the steward of King Ondaher, played the chief part. The Council of Gondor answered, "The crown and royalty of Gondor belong solely to the heirs of Meneldil, son of Anarion, to whom Isildur relinquished this realm. In Gondor this heritage is reckoned through the sons only, and we have not heard that the law is otherwise in Arnor." To this Arvedwë replied, "Elendil had two sons, of whom Isildur was the elder and the heir of his father. We have heard that the name of Elendil stands to this day at the head of the line of the kings of Gondor, since he was accounted the high king of all lands of the Dúnedain. While Elendil still lived, the conjoint rule in the south was committed to his sons. But when Elendil fell, Isildur departed to take up the high kingship of his father, and committed the rule in the south in like manner to the son of his brother. He did not relinquish his royalty in Gondor, nor intend that the realm of Elendil should be divided for ever. Moreover, in Numenor of old, the sceptre descended to the eldest child of the king, whether man or woman. It is true that the law has not been observed in the lands of exile ever troubled by war. But such was the law of our people, to which we now refer, seeing that the sons of Ondaher died childless. That law was made in Numenor, as we have learned from the king, when Tar-Aldarion, the sixth king, left only one child, a daughter. She became the first ruling queen, Tar-An-Kalime. But the law was otherwise before her time. Tar-Elendil, the fourth king, was succeeded by his son Tar-Meneldor, though his daughter Silmarion was the elder. It was, however, from Silmarion that Elendil was descended." To this Gondor made no answer. "The crown was claimed by Eärnil, the victorious captain, and it was granted to him with the approval of all the Dúnedain in Gondor, since he was of the royal house. He was the son of Siriondil, son of Kalimakil, son of Alkirias, brother of Narmakil II. Arvedui did not press his claim, for he had neither the power nor the will to oppose the choice of the Dunedain of Gondor. Yet the claim was never forgotten by his descendants, even when their kingship had passed away. For the time was now drawing near when the North Kingdom would come to an end. Arvedui was indeed the last king, as his name signifies. It is said that this name was given to him at his birth by Malbeth the seer, who said to his father, "Arvedui you shall call him, for he will be the last in Arthedain, though a choice will come to the Dunedain, and if they take the one that seems less hopeful, then your son will change his name and become king of a great realm. If not, then much sorrow and many lives of men shall pass until the Dunedain arise and are united again." In Gondor also one king only followed Eärnil. It may be that if the crown and the sceptre had been united, then the kingship would have been maintained and much evil averted. But Eärnil was a wise man and not arrogant, even if, as to most men in Gondor, the realm in Arthedain seemed a small thing for all the lineage of its lords. He sent messages to Arvedui, announcing that he received the crown of Gondor according to the laws and the needs of the South Kingdom. "But I do not forget the loyalty of Arnor, nor deny our kinship, nor wish that the realms of Elendil should be estranged. I will send to your aid, when you have need, so far as I am able." It was, however, long before Eärnil felt himself sufficiently secure to do as he promised. King Arafant continued with dwindling strength to hold off the assaults of Angmar, and Arvedui, when he succeeded, did likewise. But at last, in the autumn of 1973, messages came to Gondor that Arthedain was in great straits, and that the Witch King was preparing a last stroke against it. Then Eärnil sent his son Eärnor north with a fleet, as swiftly as he could, and with as great strength as he could spare. Too late. Before Eärnor reached the havens of Lindon, the Witch King had conquered Arthedain, and Arvedui had perished. But when Eärnor came to the Grey Havens, there was joy and great wonder among both elves and men. So great in draught, and so many were his ships, that they could scarcely find harbourage, though both the Harlond and the Forlond also were filled. And from them descended an army of power, with munition and provision for a war of great kings. Or so it seemed to the people of the north, though this was but a small sending force of the whole might of Gondor. Most of all, the horses were praised, for many of them came from the vales of Anduin, and with them were riders tall and fair, and proud princes of Rovanion. Then Círdan summoned all who would come to him, from Lindon or Anor, and when all was ready, the host crossed the Lune and marched north to challenge the Witch King of Angmar. He was now dwelling, it is said, in Fornost, which he had filled with evil folk, usurping the house and rule of the kings. In his pride he did not await the onset of his enemies and his stronghold, but went out to meet them, thinking to sweep them, as others before, into the Lune. But the host of the west came down on him out of the hills of Evendim, and there was a great battle on the plain between Nenunial and the North Downs. The forces of Angmar were already giving way and retreating towards Fornost when the main body of the horsemen that had passed round the hills came down from the north and scattered them in a great rout. Then the Witch King, with all that he could gather from the wreck, fled northwards, seeking his own land of Angmar. Before he could gain the shelter of Carn Dûm, the cavalry of Gondor overtook him, with Eärnor riding at their head. At the same time a force, under Glorfindel the Elf Lord, came up out of Rivendell. Then so utterly was Angmar defeated that not a man nor an orc of that realm remained west of the mountains. But it is said that when all was lost, suddenly the Witch-King himself appeared, black-robed and black-masked, upon a black horse. Fear fell upon all who beheld him, but he singled out the captain of Gondor for the fullness of his hatred, and with a terrible cry he rode straight upon him. Eanor would have withstood him, but his horse could not endure that onset, and it swerved and bore him far away before he could master it. Then the Witch-King laughed, and none that heard it ever forgot the horror of that cry. But Glorfindel rode up then on his white horse, and in the midst of his laughter the Witch-King turned to flight and passed into the shadows. For night came down on the battlefield, and he was lost, and none saw whither he went. Eanor now rode back, but Glorfindel, looking into the gathering dark, said, "Do not pursue him. He will not return to this land. Far off yet is his doom, and not by the hand of man will he fall." These words many remembered, but Eanor was angry, desiring only to be avenged for his disgrace. So ended the evil realm of Angmar, and so did Eanor, captain of Gondor, earn the chief hatred of the Witch-King, but many years were still to pass before that was revealed. It was thus in the reign of King Eärnil, as later became clear, that the Witch-King, escaping from the north, came to Mordor, and there gathered the other Ringraids, of whom he was the chief. But it was not until 2000 that they issued from Mordor by the pass of Cirith Ungol and laid siege to Minas Ithil. This they took in 2002, and captured the Palantir of the Tower. They were not expelled while the Third Age lasted, and Minas Ithil became a place of fear, and was renamed Minas Morgul. Many of the people that still remained in Ithilien deserted it. Eanor was a man like his father in valour, but not in wisdom. He was a man of strong body and hot mood, but he would take no wife, for his only pleasure was in fighting, or in the exercise of arms. His prowess was such that none in Gondor could stand against him in those weapon sports in which he delighted, seeming rather a champion than a captain or king, and retaining his vigour and skill to a later age than was then usual. When Eanor received the crown in 2043, the king of Minas Morgul challenged him to single combat, taunting him that he had not dared to stand before him in battle in the north. For that time, Mardil the steward restrained the wrath of the king. Minas Arnor, which had become the chief city of the realm since the days of King Telemnar, and the residence of the kings, was now renamed Minas Tirith, as a city ever on guard against the evil of Morgul. Eanor had held the crown only 7 years when the lord of Morgul repeated his challenge, taunting the king that to the faint heart of his youth he had now added the weakness of age. Then Mardil could no longer restrain him, and he rode with a small escort of knights to the gates of Minas Morgul. None of that riding were ever heard of again. It was believed in Gondor that the faithless enemy had trapped the king, and that he had died in torment in Minas Morgul. But since there were no witnesses of his death, Mardil, the good steward, ruled Gondor in his name for many years. Now the descendants of the kings had become few. Their numbers had been greatly diminished in the kinstrife, whereas since that time the kings had become jealous and watchful of those near akin. Often those on whom suspicion fell had fled to Umbar and there joined the rebels, while others had renounced their lineage and taken wives not of Numenorean blood. So it was that no claimant to the crown could be found who was of pure blood or whose claim all would allow. And all feared the memory of the kin-strife, knowing that if any such dissension arose again, then Gondor would perish. Therefore, though the years lengthened, the steward continued to rule Gondor, and the crown of Elendil lay in the lap of King Eärnil in the houses of the dead, where Eärnor had left it. The Stewards. The house of the stewards was called the House of Húrin, for they were descendants of the steward of King Minardil, Húrin of Eminardnin, a man of high Numenorean race. After his day, the kings had always chosen their stewards from among his descendants, and after the days of Pelennor, the stewardship became hereditary as a kingship, from father to son or nearest king. Each new steward indeed took office with the oath to hold rod and rule in the name of the king until he shall return. But these soon became words of ritual little heeded, for the stewards exercised all the power of the kings. Yet many in Gondor still believed that a king would indeed return in some time to come, and some remembered the ancient line of the North, which it was rumoured still lived on in the shadows. But against such thoughts the ruling stewards hardened their hearts. Nonetheless, the stewards never sat on the ancient throne, and they wore no crown, and held no sceptre. They bore a white rod only as the token of their office, and their banner was white without charge. But the royal banner had been sable, upon which was displayed a white tree in blossom beneath seven stars. After Mardil Voronwë, who was reckoned the first of the line, there followed the 24 ruling stewards of Gondor, until the time of Denethor II, the 26th and last. At first they had quiet, for those were the days of the watchful peace, during which Sauron withdrew before the power of the White Council, and the Ringwraiths remained hidden in Morgul Vale. But from the time of Denethor I, there was never full peace again, and even when Gondor had no great or open war, its borders were under constant threat. In the last years of Denethor I, the race of Uruks, black orcs of great strength, first appeared out of Mordor, and in 2475 they swept across Ithilien and took Osgiliath. Boromir, son of Denethor, after whom Boromir of the Nine Walkers was later named, defeated them and regained Ithilien. But Osgiliath was finally ruined, and its great stone bridge was broken. No people dwelt there afterwards. Boromir was a great captain, and even the Witch-King feared him. He was noble and fair of face, a man strong in body and in will, but he received a Morgul wound in that war which shortened his days, and he became shrunken with pain and died 12 years after his father. After him began the long rule of Cirion. He was watchful and wary, but the reach of Gondor had grown short, and he could do little more than defend his borders, while his enemies, or the power that moved them, prepared strokes against him that he could not hinder. The corsairs harried his coasts, but it was in the north that his chief peril lay. In the wide lands of Rovanion, between Mirkwood and the River Running, a fierce people now dwelt, wholly under the shadow of Dol Guldur. Often they made raids through the forest, until the Vale of Anduin, south of the Gladden, was largely deserted. These Balchoth were constantly increased by others of like kind that came in from the east, whereas the people of Cullen Arthon had dwindled. Cirion was hard put to it to hold the line of the Anduin. Foreseeing the storm, Cirion sent north for aid, but over late. For in that year, 2510, the Balchoth, having built many great boats and rafts on the east shores of Anduin, swarmed over the river and swept away the defenders, An army marching up from the south was cut off and driven north over the Limelight, and there it was suddenly attacked by a horde of orcs from the mountains and pressed towards the Anduin. Then out of the north there came help beyond hope, and the horns of the Rohirrim were first heard in Gondor. Eol the Young came with his riders and swept away the enemy, and pursued the Balhoth to the death over the fields of Cullen Arthon. Cirion granted to Eol that land to dwell in, and he swore to Cirion the oath of Eol, of friendship at need or at call to the lords of Gondor. In the days of Beren, the 19th steward, an even greater peril came upon Gondor. Three great fleets, long prepared, came up from Umbar and the Harad and assailed the coasts of Gondor in great force, and the enemy made many landings, even as far north as the mouth of the Isen. At the same time the Rohirrim were assailed from the west and east, and their land was overrun, and they were driven into the dales of the White Mountains. In that year, 2758, the long winter began with cold and great snows out of the north and the east, which lasted for almost 5 months. Helm of Rohan and both his sons perished in that war, and there was misery and death in Eriador and in Rohan. But in Gondor, south of the mountains, things were less evil, and before spring came Beregond, son of Beren, had overcome the invaders. At once he sent aid to Rohan. He was the greatest captain that had arisen in Gondor since Boromir, and when he succeeded his father, 2763, Gondor began to recover its strength. But Rohan was slower to be healed of the hurts that it had received. It was for this reason that Beren welcomed Saruman, and gave to him the keys of Orthonk, and from that year on Saruman dwelt in Isengard. It was in the days of Beregond that the war of the dwarves and orcs was fought in the Misty Mountains, of which only rumour came south, until the orcs, fleeing from Nandohirion, attempted to cross Rohan and establish themselves in the White Mountains. There was fighting for many years in the dales before that danger was ended. When Belecthor II, the 21st steward, died, the white tree died also in Minas Tirith, but it was left standing until the king returns, for no seedling could be found. In the days of Turin II, the enemies of Gondor began to move again, for Sauron was grown again to power, and the day of his arising was drawing near. All but the hardiest of its people deserted Ithilien and removed west over Anduin, for the land was infested by Mordor orcs. It was Turin that built secret refuges for his soldiers in Ithilien, of which Heneth Arnun was the longest guarded and manned. He also fortified again the Isle of Cair Andros to defend Anorion. Cair Andros means ship of long foam, for the isle was shaped like a great ship, with a high prow pointing north, against which the white foam of Anduin broke on sharp rocks. But his chief peril lay in the south, where the Haradrim had occupied South Gondor, and there was much fighting along the Poros. When Ithilien was invaded in great strength, King Folkwine of Rohan fulfilled the oath of Eol and repaid his debts for the aid brought by Beregond, sending many men to Gondor. With their aid, Turin won a victory at the crossing of the Poros. But the sons of Folkwine both fell in the battle. The riders buried them after the fashion of their people, and they were laid in one mound, for they were twin brothers. Long it stood, Houth in Gwanor, high upon the shore of the river, and the enemies of Gondor feared to pass it. Turgon followed Turin, but of his time it is chiefly remembered that 2 years ere his death Sauron arose again, and declared himself openly, and he re-entered Mordor long prepared for him. Then the Barad-dûr was raised once more, and Mount Doom burst into flame, and the last of the folk of Ithilien fled far away. When Turgon died, Saruman took Isengard for his own and fortified it. Ecthelion II, son of Turgon, was a man of wisdom. With what power was left to him, he began to strengthen his realm against the assault of Mordor. He encouraged all men of worth from near or far to enter his service, and to those who proved trustworthy he gave rank and reward. In much that he did, he had the aid and advice of a great captain whom he loved above all. Thorongil, men called him in Gondor, the Eagle of the Star, for he was swift and keen-eyed, and wore a silver star upon his cloak. But no one knew his true name, nor in what land he was born. He came to Ecthelion from Rohan, where he had served the King Thengal, but he was not one of the Rohirrim. He was a great leader of men, by land or by sea, but he departed into the shadows whence he came, before the days of Ecthelion were ended. Thorongil often counselled Ecthelion that the strength of the rebels in Umbar was a great peril to Gondor, and a threat to the fiefs of the south that would prove deadly if Sauron moved to open war. At last he got leave of the steward and gathered a small fleet, and he came to Umbar unlooked for by night, and there burned a great part of the ships of the corsairs. He himself overthrew the captain of the haven in battle upon the quays, and then he withdrew his fleet with small loss. But when they came back to Pelagia, to men's grief and wonder, he would not return to Minas Tirith, where great honour awaited him. He sent a message of farewell to Ecthelion, saying, "Other tasks now call me, Lord, and much time and many perils must pass ere I come again to Gondor, if that be my fate." Though none could guess what those tasks might be, nor what summons he had received, it was known whither he went. For he took boat, and crossed over Anduin, and there he said farewell to his companions, and went on alone, and when he was last seen, his face was towards the mountains of shadow. There was dismay in the city at the departure of Thorongil, and to all men it seemed a great loss, unless it were to Denethor, the son of Ecthelion, a man now ripe for the stewardship, to which after 4 years he succeeded on the death of his father. Denethor II was a proud man, tall, valiant, and more kingly than any man that had appeared in Gondor for many lives of men, and he was wise also, and far-sighted, and learned in law. Indeed, he was as like to Thorongil as to one of nearest kin, and yet was ever placed second to the stranger in the hearts of men and the esteem of his father. At the time, many thought that Thorongil had departed before his rival became his master, though indeed Thorongil had never himself vied with Denethor, nor held himself higher than the servant of his father. And in one matter only were their counsels to the steward at variance. Thorongil often warned Ecthelion not to put trust in Saruman the White in Isengard, but to welcome rather Gandalf the Grey. For there was little love between Denethor and Gandalf, and after the days of Ecthelion there was less welcome for the Grey Pilgrim in Minas Tirith. Therefore later, when all was made clear, many believed that Denethor, who was subtle in mind and looked further and deeper than other men of his day, had discovered who this stranger Thorongil in truth was, and suspected that he and Mithrandir designed to supplant him. When Denethor became steward, 2984, he proved a masterful lord, holding the rule of all things in his own hand. He said little. He listened to counsel, and then followed his own mind. He had married late, taking as wife Finduilas, daughter of Ardrahil of Dol Amroth. She was a lady of great beauty and gentle heart, but before 12 years had passed, she died. Denethor loved her, in his fashion, more dearly than any other, unless it were the elder of the sons that she bore him. But it seemed to men that she withered in the guarded city, as a flower of the seaward vales set upon a barren rock, The shadow in the east filled her with horror, and she turned her eyes ever south to the sea that she missed. After her death, Denethor became more grim and silent than before, and would sit long alone in his tower, deep in thought, foreseeing that the assault of Mordor would come in his time. It was afterwards believed that, needing knowledge, but being proud, and trusting in his own strength of will, he dared to look in the palantir of the White Tower. None of the stewards had dared to do this, nor even the kings Eärnil and Eärnor, after the fall of Minas Ithil, when the palantir of Isildur came into the hands of the enemy. For the stone of Minas Tirith was the palantir of Anarion, most close in accord with the one that Sauron possessed. In this way, Denethor gained his great knowledge of things that passed in his realm, and far beyond his borders, at which men marvelled. But he bought the knowledge dearly, being aged, before his time, by his contest with the will of Sauron. Thus pride increased in Denethor together with despair, until he saw in all the deeds of that time only a single combat between the Lord of the White Tower and the Lord of the Barad-dûr, and mistrusted all others who resisted Sauron unless they served himself alone. So time drew on to the War of the Ring, and the sons of Denethor grew to manhood. Boromir, 5 years the elder, beloved by his father, was like him in face and pride, but in little else. Rather, he was a man after the sort of King Eärnor of old, taking no wife, and delighting chiefly in arms, fearless and strong, but caring little for lore, save the tales of old battles. Faramir, the younger, was like him in looks, but otherwise in mind. He read the hearts of men as shrewdly as his father, but what he read moved him sooner to pity than to scorn. He was gentle in bearing, and a lover of lore and of music, and therefore by many in those days his courage was judged less than his brother's. But it was not so, except that he did not seek glory in danger without a purpose. He welcomed Gandalf at such times as he came to the city, and he learned what he could from his wisdom, and in this, as in many other matters, he displeased his father. Yet between the brothers there was great love, and had been since childhood, when Boromir was the helper and protector of Faramir. No jealousy or rivalry had arisen between them since, for their father's favour or for the praise of men. It did not seem possible to Faramir that anyone in Gondor could rival Boromir, heir of Denethor, captain of the White Tower, and of like mind was Boromir. Yet it proved otherwise at the test. But of all that befell these three in the War of the Ring, much is said elsewhere. And after the war, the days of the ruling stewards came to an end, for the heir of Isildur and Anarion returned, and the kingship was renewed, and the standard of the White Tree flew once more from the Tower of Ecthelion. Here follows a part of the tale of Aragorn and Arwen. Arador was the grandfather of the king. His son, Arathorn, sought in marriage Gilrain the Fair, daughter of Dirhael, who was himself a descendant of Arnath. To this marriage Dirhael was opposed, for Gilrain was young, and had not reached the age at which the women of the Dúnedain were accustomed to marry. "Moreover," he said, "Arathorn is a stern man of full age, and will be chieftain sooner than men looked for, yet my heart forebodes that he will be short-lived." But Ivorwen, his wife, who was also foresighted, answered, "The more need of haste. The days are darkening before the storm, and great things are to come. If these two wed now, hope may be born for our people, but if they delay, it will not come while this age lasts." And it happened that when Arathorn and Gilrain had been married only 1 year, Arador was taken by hill trolls in the cold fells north of Rivendell and was slain, and Arathorn became chieftain of the Dúnedain. The next year Gilrain bore him a son, and he was called Aragorn. But Aragorn was only 2 years old when Arathorn went riding against the orcs with the sons of Elrond, and he was slain by an orc arrow that pierced his eye. And so he proved indeed short-lived for one of his race, being but 60 years old when he fell. Then Aragorn, being now the heir of Isildur, was taken with his mother to dwell in the house of Elrond. And Elrond took the place of his father, and came to love him as a son of his own. But he was called Estel, that is, Hope, and his true name and lineage were kept secret at the bidding of Elrond, for the wise then knew that the enemy was seeking to discover the heir of Isildur, if any remained upon earth. But when Estel was only 20 years of age, it chanced that he returned to Rivendell after great deeds in the company of the sons of Elrond. And Elrond looked at him and was pleased, for he saw that he was fair and noble, and was early come to manhood, though he would yet become greater in body and in mind. That day, therefore, Elrond called him by his true name, and told him who he was and whose son, and he delivered to him the heirlooms of his house. "Here is the ring of Barahir," he said, "the token of our kinship from afar, and here also are the shards of Narsil. With these you may yet do great deeds, for I foretell that the span of your life shall be greater than the measure of men, unless evil befalls you, or you fail at the test. But the test will be hard and long. The sceptre of Annúminas I withhold, for you have yet to earn it." The next day, at the hour of sunset, Aragorn walked alone in the woods, and his heart was high within him, and he sang, for he was full of hope, and the world was fair. And suddenly, even as he sang, he saw a maiden walking on a greensward among the white stems of the birches, and he halted amazed, thinking that he had strayed into a dream, or else that he had received the gift of the elf minstrels, who can make the things of which they sing appear before the eyes of those that listen. For Aragorn had been singing a part of the Lay of Lúthien, which tells of the meeting of Lúthien and Beren in the forest of Neldoreth. And behold, there Lúthien walked before his eyes in Rivendell, clad in a mantle of silver and blue, fair as the twilight in Elvenhome. Her dark hair strayed in a sudden wind, and her brows were bound with gems like stars. For a moment Aragorn gazed in silence, but fearing that she would pass away and never be seen again, he called to her, crying, "Tinúviel! Tinúviel!" even as Beren had done in the elder days long ago. Then the maiden turned to him and smiled, and she said, "Who are you? And why do you call me by that name?" And he answered, "Because I believed you to be indeed Lúthien Tinúviel, of whom I was singing. But if you are not she, then you walk in her likeness." "So many have said," she answered gravely. "Yet her name is not mine, though maybe my doom will be not unlike hers. But who are you?" "Estel I was called," he said. "But I am Aragorn, Arathorn's son, Isildur's heir, lord of the Dúnedain." Yet even in the saying he felt that this high lineage, in which his heart had rejoiced, was now of little worth, and as nothing compared to her dignity and loveliness. But she laughed merrily and said, "Then we are akin from afar, for I am Arwen, Elrond's daughter, and am named also Undomiel." "Often is it seen," said Aragorn, "that in dangerous days men hide their chief treasure. Yet I marvel at Elrond and your brothers, for though I've dwelt in this house from childhood, I have heard no word of you. How comes it that we have never met before? Surely your father has not kept you locked in his hoard?" "No," she said, and looked up at the mountains that rose in the east. "I have dwelt for a time in the land of my mother's kin, in far Lothlórien. I have but lately returned to visit my father again. It is many years since I have walked in Imladris." Then Aragorn wondered, for she had seemed of no greater age than he. who had lived yet no more than a score of years in Middle-earth. But Arwen looked in his eyes and said, "Do not wonder, for the children of Elrond have the life of the Eldar." Then Aragorn was abashed, for he saw the elven light in her eyes and the wisdom of many days, yet from that hour he loved Arwen Undomiel, daughter of Elrond. In the days that followed, Aragorn fell silent, and his mother perceived that some strange thing had befallen him, and at last he yielded to her questions and told her of the meeting in the twilight of the trees. "My son," said Gilrain, "your aim is high, even for the descendant of many kings. For this lady is the noblest and fairest that now walks the earth, and it is not fit that mortal should wed with the elfkin." "Yet we have some part in that kinship," said Aragorn, "if the tale of my forefathers is true that I have learned." "It is true," said Gilrain, "but that was long ago, and in another age of this world, before our race was diminished. Therefore I am afraid. For without the good will of Master Elrond, the heirs of Isildur will soon come to an end. But I do not think that you will have the good will of Elrond in this matter." "Then bitter will my days be, and I will walk in the wild alone," said Aragorn. "That will indeed be your fate," said Gilrain. But though she had in a measure the foresight of her people, she said no more to him of her foreboding, nor did she speak to anyone of what her son had told her. But Elrond saw many things and read many hearts. One day, therefore, before the fall of the year, he called Aragorn to his chamber, and he said, "Aragorn, Arathorn's son, lord of the Dúnedain, listen to me. A great doom awaits you, either to rise above the height of all your fathers since the days of Elendil, or to fall into darkness with all that is left of your kin. Many years of trial lie before you. You shall neither have wife nor bind any woman to you in troth until your time comes and you are found worthy of it." Then Aragorn was troubled, and he said, "Can it be that my mother has spoken of this?" "No, indeed," said Elrond. "Your own eyes have betrayed you. But I do not speak of my daughter alone. You shall be betrothed to no man's child as yet. But as for Arwen the Fair, lady of Imladris and of Lorien, even star of her people, she is of lineage greater than yours, and she has lived in the world already so long that to her you are but as a yearling shoot beside a young birch of many summers. She is too far above you, and so I think it may well seem to her. But even if it were not so, and her heart turned towards you, I shall still be grieved because of the doom that is laid on us." "What is that doom?" said Aragorn. "That so long as I abide here, she shall live with the youth of the Eldar," answered Elrond, "and when I depart, she shall go with me, if she so chooses." "I see," said Aragorn, "that I have turned my eyes to a treasure no less dear than the treasure of Thingol that Beren once desired. Such is my fate." Then suddenly the foresight of his kindred came to him, and he said, "But lo, Master Elrond, the years of your abiding run short at last, and the choice must soon be laid on your children to part either with you or with Middle-earth." "Truly," said Elrond, "soon as we account it, though many years of men must still pass. But there will be no choice before Arwen, my beloved, unless you, Aragorn Arathorn's son, come between us and bring one of us, you or me, to a bitter parting beyond the end of the world. You do not know yet what you desire of me." He sighed, and after a while, looking gravely upon the young man, he said again, "The years will bring what they will. We will speak no more of this until many have passed. The days darken, and much evil is to come." Then Aragorn took leave lovingly of Elrond, and the next day he said farewell to his mother, and to the house of Elrond, and to Arwen, and he went out into the wild. For nearly 30 years he laboured in the cause against Sauron, and he became a friend of Gandalf the Wise, from whom he gained much wisdom. With him he made many perilous journeys, but as the years